Well, hello, everyone. My name is Dr. Sherry Tenpenny, and I want to extend a warm welcome to all of our Tenpenny Files premium members. During our deep dives, we have a personal conversation with our guests that we do this week with Dr. T, and we want to know a little bit more about who they are and find out what it really inspires them and keeps them going in this fight. We know a lot of these people from their public statures, from them being on the stage or the books that they've written, but you know, there's a whole human behind that. And that's what these deep dives are about, to talk a little bit more about who they really are and if they have stories they want to share, that we get to know them a little bit better. So with that, let me introduce to you our featured deep dive guest today, Ed Dowd. Edward Dowd is the founding partner of Finance Technologies, a global macro alternative investment firm. He has worked on Wall Street most of his career in both credit markets and equity markets, and he worked for many years with large firms such as HSBC, Independence Investments, and most notably, he worked for about 12 years at BlackRock as a portfolio investment manager, where he managed a $12 to $14 billion growth equity portfolio for almost 10 years. After leaving BlackRock, he founded Ocean Square Asset Management with two former BlackRock colleagues. His most recent book, Cause Unknown, begins with a close look at the actual humanity behind these statistics. When you see the people who are represented by the dry term excess mortality, it's difficult to accept that so many, particularly young, healthy people, such as athletes, more than 1,100 young athletes have died. And that we just shrug that off as this it happened out of the blue and it's just a number. Well, what Ed decided to do, and we talked about this yesterday during the This Week with Dr. T, we talked about how that book got started and what that really meant to him. But I really want to know a little bit more about who this person is. And Ed, welcome to the Deep Dive with Dr. T. And I always like to start on this interview with, tell us a little bit about where you were born and what it was like, what your childhood was like.
Sure. So I was born in Boston, Massachusetts in 1967. And I grew up in an Irish Catholic family. Both my parents are from Irish descent. I'm 100% basically Irish Catholic American. And there's no other, that's it. There's no, I've not done the DNA, but my father did, and he's 99.5%. Irish, half percent Native American. Not sure how that snuck in there, but apparently that's more than Elizabeth Warren. So my father, my father could claim status at one of the universities in Massachusetts, I guess. But so I was raised as a Catholic, and I was raised in Wellesley, Massachusetts, which is a suburb of Boston. My father worked for John Hancock Insurance. He was eventually made his way to become the head of the real estate investment department there. My mother sold real estate. She started working when women weren't really working, but she was one of the pioneers for women in the workforce. She was very good at selling real estate. And I grew up with two brothers. And so my mother had a hard job with three boys. We were 2 years apart. So my mom was hard at work for several years, and I was the oldest of the three. And I went to Wellesley Public High School, so I'm a public high school kid. What I will say is, I've heard that public education's gotten just absolutely decimated. When I was there, it was great. I learned a ton. I excelled academically. I took Latin in high school and Spanish as my languages. And I was a curious kid, and I liked to play Dungeons and Dragons. I was a nerd. I was not very athletic. I liked to play Dungeons and Dragons, and eventually would play poker. So I was not one of the cool kids. I was one of the nerds. But by senior year, everyone started hanging out, and we all kind of, you know, the barriers of the different social demarcations kind of melted, and I went off to I grew up in the 80s, so the 80s formed my cultural background, and things were changing in the 80s. As you know, there was MTV came on board, so I'm of the generation before, you know, culturally we were tempted to completely immerse ourselves in pleasure and hedonism. So I came from a family where, you worked hard and you played hard. So that was kind of my mantra. I went to Notre Dame in 1985, and I spent 4 years there at a Catholic university, and I studied finance and anthropology, double major. And quite honestly, anthropology was where I excelled because I had to excel because the classes, generally speaking, only had five people in them, so you couldn't blow them off and borrow your friend's notes. So my advice to my children these days is the secret. So I got straight A's in anthropology. I said, if you want to get straight A's, just show up to class. That's the secret. Literally, it's that easy. Show up to class, listen, because they always put something in the test that is not in the textbook that is lectured. And if you miss it, you're going to miss that question. So that's the key to success in college. And
Show up, right?
yeah, show up. Showing up is key. And when I was in my business classes, a lot of them were amphitheaters with like 100 people. So if you missed it, it wasn't that big of a deal, and you would always get someone's notes. But I spent a Notre Dame was different at the time than it is now. It was only 70%. It was 70% men and 30% women. It was all male school until the 70s, and they converted, but they converted slowly. So I went to a school where it was, in hindsight, it was actually a good thing. There weren't there were the women were smarter than us because there were fewer of them, but they had the same a number of applicants. So I went to a school where women weren't a distraction. So I formed a lot of good male relationships, and that's kind of it kind of forms a lot of how who I am today. A lot of bonding with people and having codes of conduct, and generally being a good human being. Although, we were boys becoming men, so we did stupid things. But there was, generally speaking, a code of conduct that, everybody kind of lived by the rules. And I graduated from there, and I was intrigued. I was full of I was a young man, I was full of ego and hubris, and I wanted to make my mark in the world. And I read a book called Liar's Poker. And it was a book about bond salesmen. And I wanted to become a bond salesman because that seemed like a great job, because you got an expense account, you can make a lot of money. And Wall Street always intrigued me because it was a place where you could be a nobody, and if you were good at what you did, you could become a somebody. And that was kind of the allure for me. And it's funny, Michael Lewis wrote the book, But Liar's Poker, not as a marketing material for bond salesmen. It was more of a warning. But he wrote in later years that the book actually was, he didn't realize, but the book was like something that inspired a lot of people to go to Wall Street. So he doesn't understand why, but that was it. And Liar's Poker was kind of our mantra. And so I got on the Wall Street, and I went to Chicago after Notre Dame. I was a bond salesman for HSBC, and that's where I learned. And I got that job through networking. I got it from an alumni, and I was hired as a young 22-year-old man. Normally, you needed an MBA to get these jobs, but I was very persistent, and it's one of those things in life you learn. The more you bang your head against the wall enough, you eventually get in. So I got a job at HSBC as a young bond salesman, and I was the youngest on the desk. We were in Chicago, and I was given a $10,000 a month expense account that they wanted me to spend. And so $10,000 in 1990 was a lot of money. So my job was to take clients out, get them drunk, buy them steaks and lobsters, and get trades. And that's when I learned how the world really works. It works through entertainment. And my job was to make the most amount of profit for my firm. And that's hence the name of the book, Liar's Poker. My job was to sell a bond with the most amount of markup in the bond, And that's where I learned about asymmetric information. And that's when I learned that Wall Street was creating bonds with sophisticated computer equipment, selling them to what's called the buy side, and pension funds, insurance companies, what have you, banks. And that, and we, if we had knowledge about the bond that the customer didn't have, that's how we made our money. And so my whole life, I've been looking at asymmetric information. And in fact, that's how a lot of business is done. You have information someone doesn't have, you make money. And that's just capitalism in general. That's how Wall Street always makes its money. They have better information than everybody else, and they act on it before everybody else, and they profit from it. And that's what I did at BlackRock. I took that skill set. My job was to pick a stock before everybody else figured it out. That's more noble than ripping someone's eyeballs out with a bond. So, because you're making money for your clients. But I left being a bond salesman after 5 years because I noticed something interesting. I was the youngest on the desk, and the people above me were 40 years old. They looked awful. They were half of them were alcoholics. They were all divorced. And I kept going back to the book I read in college, Death of a Salesman. And I didn't want to be Willie Loman. So I looked forward and I said, this is not a healthy way to live. In fact, my job was so intense for those 5 years. I would take Friday nights off and wouldn't go out with my friends because I was tired from entertaining all week. So it was a job that was, if you stayed in that trap, you would become very unhealthy over time. So I went back to business school at Indiana University in 1995, spent 2 years there, did very well, and then went to Donaldson Lufkin and Jenrette. So I used business school as a way to switch gears in my career and go from fixed income to equity. And I went to Donaldson Lufkin and Jenrette, which was a premier investment bank back in the day, and they were known for their equity research. And I did my equity research at DLJ in 1997 through 99. I spent 2 years there as an electric utility analyst. And you gotta remember, that was a special time on Wall Street. That was the dot-com boom. And down the hall from me were the internet guys. And they were issuing what's called initial public offerings. And there's big money in that. So you present a stock to the public. It's an IPO. All the investors around the country buy it up. And the investment bank makes a nice big fat fee. Well, those people down, and I was in boring electric utilities, which is fine by me. Those guys down the hall worked all the time. I worked hard. I worked 80 hours a week, but they were working 7 days a week because they were making tons of money. And I was a young research associate, not making much money by, today's standards, but enough to like pay rent and get food. And those kids down the hall for me, my age, were making $1 million a year. Their senior analyst was making 20 million a year.
Wow.
In the late 90s. Why was that going on? Well, there was a process called due diligence that used to be what investment banks would do. They would make sure the company had cash flows and revenues and it was an appropriate company to bring to public. That was dispensed with, and we IPO'd company after company where the metrics were eyeballs. And you all remember what happened with the dot-com boom. It eventually busted, and a lot of those stocks went to zero. There were a few companies that survived, like Amazon and Yahoo.
But even Amazon survived by the skin of its teeth, you know,
correct.
When all that
they
was
almost
happening.
Went bankrupt. Yeah. So that's where I live.
And I don't think people know that about Amazon. I think that's kind of important that people don't, you know, that weren't involved or now so they're a little bit younger than what you and I are, don't really realize that that was a really incredible, high pressured period of time. And Amazon almost went bankrupt. I mean, they barely skimmed through, you know?
Correct. They had to issue convertible. Well, one of the smartest things Bezos did is he issued convertible bonds before everything blew up, and he was able to get through with the cash and create a real business. His business was real, but it wasn't profitable at the time, but he's since grown it into an amazing endeavor. We can debate, you know, whether or not he has monopolistic power today, but at the time, you know, it was a net good at the time, like a lot of things, net goods can become at dads if they get too much power. But at the time, you know, it was, who didn't want to order a book from the internet and have it delivered to your house? It didn't seem all that nefarious at the time. But so I then went up to, I quit that job, went up to Boston to a firm called Independence Investments, which had $30 billion under management. I became a technology analyst. And I was, because of my experience in the credit markets and my my geeky nature, I was a history, I loved history. So I knew that all bubbles burst. So I knew that, you know, euphoria is a form of mass psychosis. And I knew that all my peers were running around telling me that, Ed, there's a new paradigm, a new way of doing business. And I knew that a lot of these businesses that were operating were funded with junk bonds, and that junk bonds eventually, unless the credit markets are favorable, will go bankrupt eventually. So that's how I saw the dot-com crisis coming. I parlayed that job into a portfolio management job at BlackRock in 2002. And then I saw the housing crisis come. So my whole career has been watching one fraud after another, but the frauds keep getting bigger because of the nature of the banking system. And what we have to understand is that our world is a fiat-based debt monetary system, and that requires constant blowing of credit bubbles to keep it going, and it needs constant credit creation. And once you realize that the Federal Reserve is just basically blowing bubble after bubble after bubble, you know, there was a bubble in the late 80s that turned into the SNL crisis. Then there was you know, the internet bubble that turned into the dot-com crisis. Then they printed again, and that turned into the banking crisis. And that's where we are today. The banking crisis never was solved. And if you think about it metaphysically, what happened? At the bottom of the financial crisis, the Federal Reserve and other central banks around the globe bought all the fraud that was on these banks' balance sheets and bailed out the banks. So the fraud never disappeared. So the fraud's been rolling through the system under one, you know, different hydra. It's like a growing hydra. And the fraud finally ended up on the central bank's balance sheets and never went away. And so how'd they kick that problem down the road? They solved the debt problem with more debt. You go forward to 2019, that's where we are right before COVID, and it was going to collapse. COVID was used as an excuse to keep this thing going for another 2 years, because the Federal Reserve was able to print more money under the cover of COVID, and the politicians spent more money. So I view what's been going on as just nothing more than fraud after fraud after fraud. So when I came into this situation in 2019 into 2020, my radar and my the skin on the back of my neck, or the hair on the back of my neck, was already raised. I knew something was terribly wrong, and that I needed to watch carefully what was going on. So that's why I'm just wired to look for fraud. And that's why I've been able to see these trends before most everybody else. My whole career has been, I started off as a bond salesman, but then I quickly realized I can make a good career out of getting ahead of the bubbles bursting. And I did. And I will say that when I was at BlackRock, I worked a lot. And BlackRock at the time, despite what people think it is today, was not a bad place to work. And, you know, it was a smaller firm. It grew through acquisition. So when I was there, it was in the beginning of its acquisition spree. So it was a good firm to help our clients make money, and we did, or not lose as much money as everybody else. So we did the best we could, and that's kind of my mindset is. And I changed too. I didn't realize it, but you know, looking back on it, everybody on Wall Street is part of a bigger machine that doesn't know how the machine operates. And the machine is a system of money that grows at a rate that doesn't grow at natural rates, according to God's law. God's law is the Fibonacci golden ratio. Everything in nature grows at a certain rate, according to the rate that God has put on this planet. What doesn't grow at God's rate is compounded interest that grows at a naturally high rate. And so metaphysically, I've kind of looked at the banking system as a satanic creation that, you know, has booms and busts and war cycles. And banking is in my view, metaphysically is a satanic, instrument on this earth, and this is Satan's realm. So that's kind of how I view it. And
That's
everything that goes on is going on because that debt grows at an unsustainable rate and causes wars and bankruptcies and social unrest eventually. And it's multi-generational.
Is there an end to this cycle? Will there be an end?
We need so the powers that be are trying to create a new digital bank currency system, which we can all speculate, is that the mark of the beast? I think it might be. But we need a new system. The question is, will we have a seat at the table, meaning we the people, or are the bankers and politicians going to create the new system? And that's the fight that's going on right now.
What prompted you to leave BlackRock?
I got stressed out like normally all Wall Street executives do, and I developed what's called mild depression, and I made the mistake of seeking help from the psychiatrists, and they made it worse. And so I asked BlackRock if I could leave. So I left BlackRock to get better. The pharmaceutical industry almost killed me, and I've cured my depression through spirituality, diet, and exercise, and being of service to others, because it's almost impossible to have woe is me thoughts in your head if you're helping others. So I'm currently on zero pharmaceutical products, and I have no depression, no anxiety. Basically cured myself through the power of God. And also, when you use the power of God, you have to meet him halfway. You just can't you have to take action. My action was dietary changes, exercise, and helping others.
And you started your new business with two, it's you in your bio, with two former BlackRock associates.
I started a firm with these two guys. We raised $1 million. We tried to get a seed investor. We spent 2 years doing it. We were almost successful, but unfortunately, my two partners had to go back into the workforce because their savings ran out. So we shut it down, and then COVID basically hit, and I've been trading my own money, and now I just started Affirm Finance Technologies with my two wonderful partners, Carlos and Yuri, who've done most of the work on the vaccine damage and all the excess mortality. And I'm so excited about what I'm doing now. It's unbelievable because we're helping people, and we plan, if this hedge fund's successful, we're going to plow a lot of our own personal profits into net good rather than accumulate stuff. I had stuff, didn't make me any happier. I was depressed when I had the most amount of stuff and money. I have less now, but I'm never been happier being in the service to people.
Is that what I kind of stumbled across this in your bio because I didn't know what it was. A global macro alternative investment firm. What does that mean?
Well, what that means is, well, first we've done the Humanity Project, okay, and that's pro bono. We basically calculated all the excess mortality across the globe: Europe, UK, Germany, Australia, the US, and we're going to do Canada. And we're also doing disabilities in the US and a vaccine damage report. This is pro bono because we've determined that the regulators of this planet have been captured, and the politicians have been captured. And so we have to be the watchdog of the watchdogs. That's the idea of the Humanity Project. So eventually that will become a, we're doing it for free right now. Eventually that will become a nonprofit entity. And we're currently, people are clamoring to get in to help us. So we have volunteers helping. We just started interviewing some of those people. And so the project is going to continue. Then the hedge fund is a separate endeavor that we've launched to take advantage of the way we see the world. And global macro is investing in stock futures indices, bond future indices, and commodity future indices. So it's not specific companies, it's indices. And Carlos has a proprietary system that has early economic cycle indicators that will pick up a lot of the damage we're seeing now from the vaccine, and we'll be able to predict interest rates and global economies and bet accordingly. So we're currently looking for a someone who wants to be a seed partner. And that means a significant amount of capital. We're looking for $100 million. This partner will get 20% of our firm and not only make money on their money and our strategy, they'll make money in the growth of the company. So, and then again, we pledged a lot of our profits to NetGood over time. So that's what I'm excited about. We're doing pro bono work, and then the hedge fund will be used to do more pro bono work, give to charities, some of our pet projects, which I can't talk about because some of them are so not good to the establishment that they might take issue with us. So we're going to keep some of those secret. And so that's kind of where we are. We're creating an alternative economy using the current system to create a new one.
That's, you know, that's what we need in so many different industries. I hear it all the time about the healthcare system, you know, that we need something new, something better, something different. And it really does need to be different. I think that the healthcare system is, people are never going to trust their doctors again. And they're never going to trust the healthcare system of what they've done to their family members. You know, you have dying family members in the hospital that you're not allowed to go and see. I mean, all the different things. I mean, everybody's been touched by this. And I've kind of said, I don't think there's anything we can do to dismantle that. It's just kind of a big, ugly system that is going to have to implode under its own weight. But we, in the meantime, can start something better that's really focused on health and on keeping you well and getting you well and off of your pharmaceutical drugs and incorporating spirituality into your physical healing. They, you know, Descartes separated them back 200 and some years ago that said, the church, you go take care of the spirit and the physicians will take care of the body, like they were not intertwined. And they are. And so, you know, starting a whole new system in a lot of different areas is what we're going to have to do to be able to survive this going forward, for sure.
I agree 100%. And, you know, through my journey of depression and healing, I'm a thinker and I like to analyze things. So I did a lot of thinking, what is depression? So they tell you what depression is. They give you a pill and say you have a chemical imbalance. Depression is, in my mind, an inability to accept things as they are, and you ruminate constantly over and over again, hoping that, you know, your plight would be different rather than being in acceptance of what it is, giving it over to God and letting your brain be free of all the worry and nonsense of the future thinking. And when I was depressed, my brain couldn't stop ruminating about the future and about things that didn't exist. I was constantly in fear. Fear of the unknown, fear of things that weren't real yet. And once I started my healing journey, a lot of my healing journey was present moment thinking. And what I've learned, and this is to your point about the different healthcare strategies that need to pop up, we are not just we're spiritual beings, we're mental beings, and we're physical beings, and they all operate together, and they all affect the body. And, you know, we are energy centers. We have three primary energy centers, our brain, our heart, and our digestive system. And when one of them goes wrong, like depression, the reason why your body shuts down and you can't really do anything is because the body is saying to the rest of the body, there's too much energy being used in the brain. If we continue, all systems go, you will die. I think it's nature's way of shutting down your body so you survive. And so, like, you heal through stopping your brain from thinking. I call it stinking thinking all the time. And that's what I was doing. And I was in a victimhood, woe is me, pity party. And to get out of a pity party, help other people, because you can't hold those two thoughts. You can't feel sorry for yourself while helping someone else. And as you help people, you feel better about yourself. So sitting around thinking about yourself and your depression is not going to help. And taking a pill is not going to help, in my humble opinion. And I've seen person after person, and there are some depressions that are severe that do require some medical attention, but maybe electroshock therapy, maybe something else, but not pills.
Yeah, you know, I mean, interestingly enough, it sort of reminds me, you hearing you talk about that, There was a book that I read in the early 90s. It was when I was first started. It was probably around 95-ish. It was when I was first moving from emergency medicine and going to Cleveland to open my integrative practice that I've had here in Cleveland since 96. And I remember this book, actually was an audio book I was listening to, and it was called Remarkable Recovery. And what these two psychologists had done is they had taken 3,000 patients who had recovered from cancer, and they interviewed all of these people, and they divided into five categories. Did they do all conventional medicine? Did they do all alternative medicine? Did they do the third category? Did they do a kind of a combination of both? The fourth category was all faith healing and prayer. And the fifth category, they didn't really do anything. It just went away. And they thought if they could find a commonality across those five things, that that would be very useful for helping people in the future to resolve their cancer issue. And what they came up with, I thought was really important, and it applies to, I think, almost any health condition. The first thing they did these three things across the board. One was clean up your life, you know, get rid of the junk food, stop smoking, stop drinking, you know, eat organic, you know, really clean up that physical part of your life. The second part, and equally important, was get real with your God, however you defined your God. If you were a Hindu or a Muslim, or you were Jewish, or you were Christian or Catholic, to make God, spirituality, all of that God in your life really, really meaningful and really important in your life. And the third thing that you had to do, and it didn't matter if you did one and or two, if you didn't do the third part, people either didn't get better or they had a recurrence of their cancer. And the third part was the forgiveness work, that they had some big hurt in their life somewhere. I mean, maybe they were 4 years old and their sibling broke their favorite toy, or, you know, something happened to them somewhere in their lifetime that was something that needed to do forgive them. They didn't need to forget it, because you can't have amnesia, but they needed to do the forgiveness work. And what the psychologist had said of those three things, that you had to clean up your life, get right with spirit, but if you didn't do the third part, the first two didn't really matter. And I think that you can kind of take that across the board, almost any health condition. And like what you were saying about depression, you know, figuring out what it was, forgiving it and letting it go. And then you can focus on present tense sort of things is a really important part of healing overall.
Yeah, you have to forgive yourself, which I did. You have to forgive anybody else that you think harmed you. Usually you have a part in that, but you have to forgive.
Yeah.
Because once you forgive, forgiveness, yes, it's for the other person, but it's mostly for you, because once you forgive someone and you do it properly, they no longer occupy any space in your head. You don't have revenge fantasies. You don't have resentments. You move on. And that's why forgiveness is so important of yourself or anybody you think wronged you. You forgive, and then you can clear your mind and you don't have thoughts about the past, and you live in the present moment. It's so important. We have to go into the future, but we don't want to stay there too long. You know, I always come back to the present moment. I do a lot of Wim Hof breathing, and I do a ton of fasting, which also helped with my depression. Fasting is a way to stay in the present moment and just to reflect. And I do fast by myself. I don't tell people, because sometimes in the Bible, you want to do a fast where you're not bragging about your fasting. You want to do it privately. Sometimes you do it with others as a communal thing. But fasting is something that really centers you in the present moment, focuses you on what's important. And I think it's in almost every religion talks about fasting. There's no mistake. And I think a lot of the reason why the medical establishment doesn't talk about it is because it's free and you can't monetize it. You just stop eating.
You know? Good point. And drink more water, right?
Yeah, drink water.
Drink more water.
Yeah.
So you talk about God a lot. We talked about this a little bit yesterday. What is your personal spirituality about? How does that look in your life?
So, you know, I'm what you call lapsed Catholic. I wouldn't say that organized religion is 100% bad, but the problem I have with organized religion is that it's a middleman in many ways. And the middleman is, we're going to tell you how to pray, and you come to church to pray. Here's the thing. We all have a conscious direct contact with God if we allow it. And Once you realize that, I mean, I talk to God a lot, and I don't ask him for things. I just say, what should I do next? Should I work? Like, you don't ask for things. You say, God, help me forgive this person. God, what is your will for me? And he'll show you if you have an open mind and you do this all the time. I mean, I'm here before you today on this journey because I let God run the show. I'm not here because I made plans to be here.
I'm sure. I'm sure.
I mean, there's a saying I've heard a lot, and it applies to me. I had plans. God had a better plan.
And you just have to open yourself up. I've heard the expression, you want to hear God laugh, tell him your plans, right?
Right.
Seriously.
I'm deeply spiritual. I do go to some, I believe in Christ. And I go to some different types of churches now. But I'm not, because I'm so busy, my service work is to humanity at the moment. That doesn't mean I won't go back to a church more regularly. I'm not opposed to it, but that's how my faith operates. And I help others, and that's what I do.
That's awesome. Have you traveled much?
Yes, I've been to, when I went to go meet, I'm now divorced, but when I was meeting the meet the parents moment, my ex-wife's Japanese, and I went to Thailand and then Nepal, and really had my first dinner with my future in-laws in Nepal. That was interesting. I've been to Japan, I've been to the UK, I've been to Ireland, I've been to Mexico, I've been to Canada, and I live on Hawaii. I've been to Bali. So that's where I've been.
Any of those stand out as your favorite?
I like Nepal the best.
Wow.
And it was, and I wasn't fully conscious of my life as I am now, but I was struck by the abject poverty of Nepal, but how peaceful and happy everyone was. And there's a spirituality there that just accepted what was going on, and they weren't sad about it. Does that make sense? It's just like they were at peace with what was going on, and poverty is what's going on in Nepal for the most part.
So it's accepted the acceptance of what is, you know, it is what it is, and you're in the active choice to be happy.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah,
that's really great. Do you, what do you do when you're not doing numbers and all of these different things? What do you like to do for fun?
I hike. I'm an avid hiker. There's a trail here called the Wahee Ridge Trail. It's a 1500 foot incline, and it's my meditation practice. I hike up it as fast as I can, and then I run down it. And when I run down, it's not easy. I'm in good shape, so this took time to get where I am now. But when I run down, you have to think out two or three steps ahead, and you can't hold any other thought in your head. So I'm focused in the present moment on my breath, my steps for, 20 minutes as I run the 2 miles down the trail. And it's very peaceful. And people look at me like I'm insane because most people don't run down this trail, but I do because it's a steep incline on the way down. And I've gotten to the point where I memorize certain footsteps, and that's kind of where I go to get back in nature. And just I have a lot of my greatest thoughts after that hike, not during it because I'm in folk, but afterwards a lot of epiphanies come to me.
How did you end up in Hawaii?
After Black Rock, I got married in Hawaii in 2001. My ex-wife's Japanese, and she had a rich uncle that had two homes on Maui. So we came to Maui throughout our whole marriage, and she wanted to move here and start a business. I was going to become an entrepreneur, so we said, let's do it. And so we came here to basically just restart the marriage, and the depression caused some issues in the marriage. Unfortunately, we couldn't save it, but we did restart our life. My kids are great. My ex-wife is the best mom on the planet. So things could be worse. And my kids live on Maui with me. My son is a freshman at UCLA, or sophomore at UCLA. And what I love about my relationship with my son is, unlike my relationship with my dad, My dad and I became friends later, but I took a different tack with my son. I knew what he was going to do because I did it. So I just said, "Look, I know what you're going to do. You're going to party. You're going to do what boys do. Just tell me about it. I can guide you through it." So like, I don't get mad. I want to be there for his mistakes so I can guide him through it. But he's a really good kid and doesn't make a lot of mistakes, so it's good. But you know, he asked me questions about the world. I never asked my dad anything. That's just the way it was. This is kind of a dysfunctional Catholic, you know, my way or the highway kind of thing. But I've decided to break that pattern. And my son and I talk often. I talk to my girls. I have two daughters. So I've taken the tack of being a parent that needs to download what I know into them. You can't yell at them. You can only instruct them through narrative and story and being gentle and knowing they're going to make mistakes. And you know, you can't protect them, so because they're going to do what they're going to do, but you can guide them. That's what
I'm
trying
to do. And
you
said you had two daughters? Is that what you said?
Two daughters. Yeah.
Two daughters. Are they younger? Are they with you there in Hawaii now?
Yeah. One's a senior in high school. One's a sophomore in high school. And I recently found out that the senior in high school doesn't even like boys and it's not dating at the moment. So whatever my ex-wife was doing, thank you.
That's great. That's
yeah.
good.
She's well, focusing on herself and her academics. And she, you know, I asked her, "Why aren't you dating any boys?" She's like, "I grew up with these boys. They're all idiots."
Well, you know, that's probably a really good observation. Good for her. That's great.
Yeah.
Well, as we close, this has been just a delightful conversation. I've just so enjoyed learning more about your life and what motivates you. I've learned, you know, about the banking system and how it really runs and, you know, kind of the different things that are going on in the world. As we close out our interview here today for Deep Dive for our premium podcast members, what sort of words of wisdom would you like to leave with them? Because you have a lot to share and a lot to say.
If I had to give one piece of advice that has really affected me and made me a much better person is two things. Live in the present moment as much as you can. That's where God is. The devil, I believe, is in the past and the future. The more you stay there, the more the devil can get to you. Fear lies in the future, and resentments and anger lie in the past. So stay in the present moment. Keep, and that's you can avoid a lot of stress and anxiety by doing that, because you know, even if you know something bad might be coming, it hasn't happened yet. And at the moment where you are, you're fine. Everything's fine. So do that. And then you also need to take a big personal inventory of yourself and your character defects. And I've done that. I know when someone says something to me and I start to feel something like anger, jealousy, rage, it's usually me. And I try not to say anything and I pause. So I've avoided a lot of confrontation in my life. And I've found that I'm my own worst enemy. So if you can figure out what your character defects are and know that when you feel something that hurts you, it's usually your ego. And more often than not, it's unintentional. And you can avoid and go through life with much greater poise and dignity and grace instead of being someone that, you know, loses control all the time.
Very well said. And I really liked what you said about fear is in the future and resentment is in the past. If you can stay in the present moment, you aren't in either one of those. I think that's really, really, really wise. Very wise advice.
And the Bible basically says that God is with you now.
Right. It's now. We are not guaranteed the next 5 minutes. So,
correct.
You know, where you are right now is really important. Well, Ed, thank you so much. And I did want to say to all of the listeners who are here, you know, this is the book. This is Ed's book, The Cause Unknown, The Epidemic of Sudden Deaths of 21 and 22. It really is a requiem to the dead. I mean, it really is a memorial thing. And, you know, I said yesterday when we did our deep dive, I said, literally, you could take this book, walk into a court of law, lay it down and say, here is, you know, the evidence, this is exhibit one, I rest my case, because everything that we need to know about these tragedies, about these young people that were healthy. I mean, we talked a lot about that. I know you've talked a lot about it on your interviews. And I think this was maybe a little different type of conversation, but I think it's really important. The last time I looked, which was yesterday, was still sold out on Amazon, but you can go and pre-order it so that when it does become available, and everybody needs to have a hard copy of this. I know that it's available as an ebook. But there is just something really important. I mean, there were a couple of the young people's pictures that just really kind of grabbed me by the heart, you know, and you just look at these people, young people, and you know that they're somebody's daughter or sister or best friend or mom or wife or husband. And those are real life people that died suddenly and unexpectedly and absolutely unnecessarily. And bringing it to life was really, really an important work that you've done. Very important work.
Well, thank you. And what we wanted to do is take and put a human face on the tragedy and marry it with the metadata. And as you know, when you go into metadata, there's numbers in the spreadsheet and you can lose sight of what's really happened. So that's why this book, we wanted to show both.
It really, and you did it. You what you set out to do, you've accomplished. And kudos to you and your co-writer, the person who is it, Gavin somebody?
Gavin DeBecker.
Yeah.
Yeah. He contributed a tremendous amount of research to this book. This was a collaborative effort, team effort. Jeff Toll works for Skyarch Publishing. He did an amazing job with the QR codes. This book was put together pretty quickly, but it was a team effort. I'm the author of most of the prose, but and I said, do you want to sell this as a team? They said, no, you're the man. So they made me the man.
Okay. So you're the man. Well, thank you for being the man, because this was such important work. So Ed, thank you. And thank you so much for your candid disclosure. It's such a great conversation. I'm really grateful that we had this extra time, that I get to know you a little differently. So when I see you on all the other interviews, because I watch a lot of what you say, you know, I'll have a little peek behind the curtain of a little bit more about who this person is and what drives you and what's really important. And thank you so much for sharing that. So as we close out today, I want to say a special thank you to our premium podcast members. Your work makes all of these things possible for us. We try to make it really worth your while, and we want to thank you personally again. Please be sure to get this book, Cause Unknown. Be sure that you get this. If it's not available at Amazon, you might be able to get it right off of Skyhorse and other different places. But seriously, you can go out and pre-order it. We mentioned yesterday that they realized that these are flying off the shelf, and they're doing additional print runs. It's a lifetime book. This is something, it's not something that you sit down and read necessarily. You can really get everything about it just by flipping through it and looking at the pictures. You've got friends and family members that are on the line and think that you're a crazy tinfoil hat conspiracy theorist. This is the book. In fact, somebody sent me a text message today of something that came off of their Telegram page that says, you need to find yourself a conspiracy theorist and befriend them so that they can explain to you what's happening. And I thought that was really well said, because those of us that have been standing in the front line and doing this for going on 3 years now, you know, and have been the control group, that we're the unvaccinated, we're the ones that don't have that, we're the control group. We're sadly going to have the last say.
In a time when truth is censored, one name stands out: Dr. Sherry Tenpenny, the relentless seeker of knowledge and defender of freedom. Explore groundbreaking findings at drtenpenny.com. Ignite your mind with riveting podcasts, explosive articles, research-driven substacks, webinars, ebooks, and more. In an era plagued by environmental toxins and vaccine-related exposures, Dr. Tenpenny has expertly crafted a selection of safe detox protocols that facilitate profound healing at a cellular level. It's time to cleanse, rejuvenate, and restore your body vitality. With heart damage on the rise, Dr. Tenpenny introduces nationwide ECP therapy to repair hearts and achieve optimal health. Seize the opportunity and embrace the wealth of resources, information, and health recommendations awaiting you at drtenpenny.com, and become a Tenpenny podcast member to join our mission in the quest for uncensored truth, the health of our nation, and medical freedom.